The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, podcast listeners, Ben Wittes here. At Lawfare headquarters the past few weeks, we have been feverishly working on a new podcast documentary series, which we are really excited to start releasing in the coming couple of weeks. In the meantime, we thought we would give you a bit of a teaser with the following trailer before this week's show episode.
Breaking news out of Washington. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has concluded his investigation and delivered his final report to U.S. Attorney General William Barr.
On April 18, 2019, the Justice Department released the redacted Mueller report to the public. The 448-page document details a story that has captured America's attention.
From Russian plots to interfere with our election to constitutional questions of executive power, the Mueller report is potentially one of the most important and consequential documents of our time.
But there's a problem. Very few people have actually read it.
2 years ago, the acting attorney general asked me to serve as special counsel, and he created the special counsel's office. It is important that the office's written work speak for itself. It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions, and the report is my testimony.
The charges say it was the work of 12 officers of Russian military intelligence.
The report did not clear the president of obstruction of justice, who relentlessly sought to use top White House staffers to, quote, curtail the investigation.
That clearly stated that the Russian government was in fact behind the interference operations that we were seeing at the time.
If you endeavor to obstruct justice but fail, it's still a crime. If you obstruct justice but it turns out there's no underlying crime, it's still a crime.
There was no collusion with Russia. The most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
The Mueller report outlines disturbing evidence that President Trump engaged in obstruction of justice and other misconduct.
They made a decision that there was no obstruction, so that makes it a complete and total exoneration. I don't know any other way to look at it.
There is still so much confusion about the report, what it says, who it implicates, and what it means for our country. I'm Benjamin Wittes.
And I'm Susan Hennessy. At Lawfare, we are distilling the report into a multi-part audio narrative series, telling you the story of what's in this document, the story Robert Mueller wants you to understand.
And I will close by reiterating the central allegation of our indictments, that there were multiple, systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American.
To learn more, subscribe to The Report wherever you get your podcasts.
The best case scenario out of this ad hoc meeting would be that there's actually something going on behind the scenes, some secret negotiation that we don't know about that brings North Korea back into the NPT in an agreement that covers the entire country and sets up this very robust access and verification regime. I don't think anybody thinks that's happening, but that would be the best case scenario. The worst case scenario, of course, is this idea of a nuclear freeze that Kim Jong-un takes this as like, hey, we're good. I don't actually have to take any further steps right now. And that's a problem not only because of North Korea, a country that has something like 20 to 30 weapons at its disposal, but anytime you're talking about nuclear politics, you're never talking about one country, right? North Korea isn't just about North Korea. North Korea is also about Iran, right? So you can't give one sweetheart deal to a country like North Korea that actually has nuclear weapons and is testing and then insist on an entirely different standard with a country like Iran, not to mention other countries in the Middle East that are also looking at whether or not they would like to have a nuclear weapons program. Nuclear policy is always about more than the one country that you're dealing with.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 13th, 2019. Our friends from the National Security Institute at George Mason University stopped by earlier this week for their third edition of Fault Lines to discuss a slew of U.S. foreign policy challenges. Lester Munson, Jody Herman, and Dana Strahl, all former Senate Foreign Relations Committee staffers, as well as Matthew Hyman, an NSI senior fellow and experienced international and national security attorney, stopped by to talk about Iran, the G20, North Korea, and what other U.S. foreign policy issues they are watching. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 434, the National Security Institute on hot topics in U.S. foreign policy.
Jody, I want to throw it over to you first. We're looking at a lot of crazy things happening in the Middle East right now, all related to Iran, it seems. There are huge tensions between Israel and Iran in Syria. There are huge tensions between the U.S. and Iran in the Persian Gulf. There are near military attacks on each other. We have sanctions ratcheting up from the U.S. We have Iran enriching uranium past its limits under the JCPOA. They're over 300 kilograms of enriched uranium. They're getting up to the 3.67% enriched limit. They're putting pressure on Europe. The U.S. is putting pressure on Iran. It's a big mess. There's a lot of things going on. How do you start to sort out U.S. policy right now and what the Iranians are trying to do vis-a-vis President Trump?
Right. So it seems like the Iran story is never over. If you work on foreign policy in Washington, it's kind of a gift that keeps on giving, if you will. So, you know, Iran's an interesting story right now, and it's very clear to me that Iran is looking for leverage, right? So they did very openly, publicly, transparently cross this threshold for low enriched uranium exceeding the 300 kilograms that was laid out in the nuclear agreement. And that's concerning, but it's also, you have to put it in context. This is not Iran making a dash for the bomb. This is Iran making a dash for a splash, if you will. They are looking to get people's attention, the international community's attention, and to set the stage for potentially maybe a new negotiation down the line. And it's certainly a reaction by Iran to U.S. to further U.S. sanctions and maybe looking to place a wedge between the United States and its allies, particularly its European allies, on this issue. Of course, Europe not being particularly happy that Iran pulled out of the nuclear agreement.
Let me quick follow up. How successful is Iran being in driving a wedge between the United States and its European allies on this? It would seem like from the outside that the Europeans are very torn. They very much want the JCPOA to continue. They're not thrilled with Trump ratcheting up sanctions, but behind the headlines, how successful has Iran been in winning over the Europeans?
I think a little bit, right? The Europeans are pretty wed to this deal, and I think for the people who were heavily involved in the negotiations in the first instance, this wasn't an easy negotiation process. It's not as if you can just pick up where they left off when we were talking about a fix the deal instead of kill the deal. It's not so easy just to go back to the negotiating table necessarily. And then I think secondarily on the sanctions piece is it's not clear where the administration will go with further sanctions. Like you can levy those sanctions, but for people involved in the lead up to the Iran deal, we were kind of at our wits' end in terms of what additional pressure we could put on Iran. Like we had kind of hit a point where while it would be lovely to reduce Iran's oil exports to zero, nobody in the sanctions community thought that was a political reality, because what it meant was countries like China and Turkey and India cutting their imports of Iranian oil to zero. None of the they weren't going to, or they didn't have the flexibility to. And so where that leaves you in terms of sanctions is in a standoff. Like, either you're going to sanction the Bank of China, or you're going to balk.
Dana, let's pick that up and advance it to today. What kind of leverage does the U.S. have left on Iran? We're going for maximum pressure with economic sanctions. Is there anything left that the administration can do to hold over the heads of the Iranians to bring them to the table? President Trump said he's not looking for regime change. He just wants a new nuclear deal. Kind of an amazing thing to say. What kind of leverage does he have beyond what he's already done?
What was so surprising about what the president said in terms of "I just want a new nuclear deal" is that it undermines the entire argument for getting out of the Iran nuclear agreement in the first place, which is that the agreement only addressed the nuclear issue and not Iranian support for terrorism, not Iran's abysmal human rights record, not its other destabilizing activities, etc. So now you actually have the president going back and undermining the original pretext for how we got to today. In terms of what more leverage, I think that officials within the Trump administration believe that there are further sanctions. I think the president even tweeted today, on the day we're recording this podcast, that more sanctions are coming, this time not with the Game of Thrones logo. More sanctions are coming. The issue is, I think, taking a big step back here, ratcheting up sanctions on Iran, maintaining sanctions on Russia, trade war with China, agitating the Europeans at every opportunity. At some point, U.S. policy is pushing all of our adversaries, not the Europeans, but Chinese, Russians, Iranians, closer together. And at some point, this isn't just about U.S. sanctions and what more we have to leverage. At what point do we negotiate ourselves out of any further leverage? And then here's the big question here. The point of sanctions is not an end in and of themselves. The point of sanctions is to get to a new opportunity for a negotiation. Iran, given the manner in which the United States has approached its policy and what it's communicating, Iran inside the regime is not a monolithic actor in and of itself. They're clearly having a debate, and I think you can see some of the debate within Tehran playing out in what looks like various responses of the Iranians. Some of it's attacking tankers. There's allegations of cyber warfare. There's trying to pressure the Europeans. And frankly, now the Iranians are poking the Europeans in the eye, whereas before they had them on sight with them.
Yeah. Just one quick thing I'd say is, when you talk about sanctioning Iran, you have to remember that the U.S. doesn't have its own trading relationship with Iran. We don't have a robust economic engagement with Iran. For sanctions to work on Iran, you need everybody else in the world to abide by those sanctions. It's not something we can do on our own. You can sanction third countries. You can sanction the Bank of England, but nobody wants to be in that situation.
Okay. But let me push back a little bit, and then I want to turn to Matthew and push back and say, the sanctions have been pretty effective, right? The reimposition of sanctions by Trump, the maximum pressure, has driven the Iranians crazy. We've seen their oil exports go way down. They've got huge economic problems at home. It seems to have had, I think, even more of an impact than the administration thought it was going to have. Let me let Matthew kind of jump in here and talk about the sanctions. And by the way, one of the things you might want to address, I'm not sure the point of sanctions from Trump, until he just said this thing recently, was to bring Iran back to the negotiating table. I was under the impression the point of the sanctions was to put Iran back in a box, or to at least try to put them back into a box so they would stop attacking Saudi Arabia, doing terrible things in Syria, challenging the Israelis every chance they got. I didn't read the new sanctions as a way to get back to the negotiating table until just recently. Matthew, do you want to jump in here?
Thanks. I think there are two ways to think about the sanctions regime right now. So we heard the discussion around what else can be done. Well, we know what else can be done, because we heard the State Department announce yesterday that they and Treasury were sanctioning now leaders of Hezbollah in Lebanon. And the Trump administration is now pushing other countries to say, when it comes to Hezbollah in Lebanon, many of you have always taken the view that the military wing is one thing, the politicians are something else. The military should be considered terrorists, the politicians not. And the Trump administration's view is they're one and the same. And now it appears the UK and Argentina take the same view. So I think there are opportunity for widening the sanctions net is going after Iran's proxies, which that's clearly the path they're on right now. The other thing on your point, Les, about, well, what is the end game with the sanctions regime? I view it similar to you. I think the United States is in a somewhat advantageous position of having really rocked Iran's economy. They have reduced their oil exports. I think their oil exports are now 10% of what they once were. I think the United States can sit back and take a long game here and wait for Iran to do something really erratic or stupid, which they are likely to do because they've demonstrated that stupidity in the past. That will push the Europeans towards us. And just one last point on this. We always hear that in Iran, it's not a monolithic regime. Well, it is pretty monolithic because the people on top is the supreme leader, Khamenei, and the clerics. And the clerics have a very clear-cut view. And so when you hear about, well, they're reformist politicians and this policy is really empowering the IRGC and the clerics, they've always been empowered. And I don't think that changes the dynamic at all.
So I would just say I think we've already seen the Iranians do something erratic. That was attack oil tankers, including a Japanese oil tanker, while the prime minister of Japan was visiting Iran, and then get videotaped taking some mines off one of the tankers. That is erratic. The point of sanctions – so this gets back to Les's question. What was the intent of the sanctions? So Pompeo actually laid it out. The Secretary of State, a little over a year ago, he laid out 12 conditions. And if the Iranians were willing to address those 12 conditions, then sanctions pressure would be relieved. And the point, as we understand from the Trump administration, was not regime change, change in the nature of the regime. However, those 12 conditions basically are regime change. So here's the deal, right? Finally, getting back to Les's original question, what more could the United States do? What the United States could do is put a credible threat for use of military force on the table if the Iranians continue to do something erratic or do something again. The problem now is our bluff has already been called. Apparently, the president doesn't want to risk the lives of civilians in any sort of attack. So he's already laid that red line out. And then let's again remind ourselves, the effect of our sanctions is only as effective as people and governments play along and as long as partners are willing to stand with us in confronting Iran. And after the risk of military confrontation between the United States and Iran, you actually saw Gulf governments say, well, we're not exactly sure. The intelligence may not be exactly what it is. We don't want military confrontation. So again, how does the United States stand credibly and risk or threaten these other things if you have people and governments that we need alongside us hedging?
Right. So the one thing we haven't talked about in this conversation is where Congress is at on these issues. And on this, particularly on the issue of the U.S. challenging Iran militarily, where Congress, I think it's pretty clear we have a Democratic majority in the House now. And while there's a majority in the Senate, it's not clear that there's a majority for that would support an AUMF that had the United States attacking Iran. So Congress is kind of waiting to see, I think, how this plays out a little bit. You won't see new sanctions from Congress. You're also certainly not going to see an AUMF from Congress. And even Democrats who oppose the nuclear agreement, and there were several of them, are really skeptical about the administration's current approach.
All right. So let's try and go fast here and talk about where the two parties are on the Hill. Matthew, my read of the Republicans is they're largely backing the president. If they had any second thoughts about pulling out of the JCPOA, those are way in the rearview mirror. They've been both rhetorically and legislatively backing his play vis-a-vis Iran in the Middle East so far. We'll let Jody and Dana kind of explain where the Democrats are. But I think aside from the AUMF question, my read is, which I don't necessarily view as a real issue, because if something's going to happen militarily, I think the U.S., any military action would be in response to something the Iranians did, which I don't necessarily think implicates an AUMF, at least right away. But talk about, short of the AUMF question, talk about where are the Republicans on the Hill? How are they posturing themselves in terms of the president? Am I off base in thinking they're pretty much solidly behind him at this point?
I think the president has extremely solid backing on the Iran issue from folks on the Hill. And to the extent that there are any dissenters, they are the typical dissenters you hear from, such as Rand Paul and others, that take a very different view of national security matters. And so I think by and large, Trump enjoys the backing of the Republican caucus on both sides of the Capitol.
Can I ask a question, though? Do you think he enjoys the backing on the maximum pressure economic sanctions policy, or also if we get to a military confrontation, he's going to continue to have the backing of his party in the event of kinetic action?
Well, you've just loaded a ton of ifs there. So I think he's got the full-fledged backing of the caucus on the sanctions issue. I think on kinetic issues, if we get into a shooting war, I think it could fall out all different kinds of ways, but it's going to largely depend on what Iran does, because as you yourself just said, Trump is reticent to use force, but I don't think he's going to be reticent to use it if they give him a reason to do so. And I don't think the Republicans are going to run backwards and say, oh, no, no, you shouldn't do that if Iran, you know, kills U.S. troops in the region or kills critical allies.
So what if they don't kill U.S. troops in the region, but they just keep attacking oil tankers and drive the price of oil up? Then what happens to the Republican support for Trump's plan?
I think it continues.
I think part of the reason – I totally agree with Matthew. I think the reason – Republicans are still with the president, even on the use of force issue, is because he's been so clearly against actual military conflict with Iran. Now, it's been in a Trumpian way where he kind of launches the attack and then pulls it back at the last second. But he's also explicitly said he's not interested in another war in the Middle East. I think that's got a lot of credibility inside the party, believe it or not. And I think that's the reason it's easy for Republicans to kind of back his play here, is because they don't see him as actually having any desire to get into kind of any kind of broad conflict with Iran in the Middle East.
I would just offer that is the issue, right? That's the issue, is the playbook is way out there in the public space for Iran. So they can just keep doing things short of American blood, poke, poke, poke in the eye, oil prices go up.
But what does that do for Democrats on the Hill? Aside from the question of the AUMF, where they're pretty much – it seems to be united against an AUMF for Iran, how do Democrats play this? I think – tell me if I'm wrong – there's a dilemma for Democrats. They – on the one hand, they can't support Trump. They're resisting. They don't want to be seen as doing anything that helps him. But they also don't want to make it look like they're doing anything that takes the side of Iran in this conflict. It's got to be a little bit of a dilemma. How are they dealing with that?
So nobody in the U.S. Congress is taking the side of Iran, right? That's not a thing. What is a thing is the fact that Congress, the Senate, has already actually taken a vote on funding for any military initiative to counter Iran, and that vote was, in fact, bipartisan. To be fair, that involved on the Republican side, Paul Collins-Lee, the members of the Senate that you would expect to support that type of initiative. But it in fact happened, and they in fact had a majority.
All right, let's close out this segment with a yes or no question, kind of a lightning round here at the end. Yes or no. In the next 18 months, will Iran and the U.S. go back to the negotiating table, Dana?
No,
I don't think so.
Matthew?
No way.
I don't think so either. 0 for 4. All right, let's turn to our next topic, which is North Korea. So, of course, as everyone now knows, at the end of the G20, President Trump tweeted to Kim Jong-un, hey, let's go meet at the DMZ in Korea. They went. They had this meeting on television. Trump walks into North Korean territory across the little fake line there by the building on the DMZ.
You put your right foot in. You take your right foot out.
You do the hokey pokey.
And exactly.
And you turn around and walk out of North Korea.
You turn around and walk out, hopefully, if all goes well. So they had this meeting. It made news. It made headlines. It dominated cable TV for at least a day or two. You have to admit the ratings were very, very high for the show. Totally unclear what it actually means in terms of where the U.S. and North Korea are going next in this very strange public negotiation that's happening. We've had a couple of summits. We've had this thing that happened at the DMZ. What does this mean? Is it all just for show? Was there any substance at all that occurred in Korea between Kim Jong-un and President Trump? Matthew, I'll let you go first on this one.
Not much. I mean, I think it was a lot for show. I think it's entertaining. It's interesting. But I don't think it takes – I don't think it changes the fundamentals of the issue which the Trump administration's wrestled with, which the Obama administration wrestled with the Bush and the Clinton and the H.W. Bush administration wrestled with, which is you've got an intransigent, tyrannical regime in North Korea. You've now got a nuclear problem, and I don't think there are any easy solutions to that. So, you know, crossing lines and doing hopscotch in the DMZ is interesting, but I don't think anything has substantively changed.
Dana, isn't there some value here that the two leaders have met, they've talked, it seems It seems affable, if nothing else. And the North Koreans have said they'll bring in some new folks. Who knows what happens to the old folks who are negotiating? They'll bring in some new folks to begin talks again. Isn't this overall a good thing? Isn't it a positive development that happened?
Well, the president certainly insists that the positive is that the North Koreans haven't done anything else bad since he started talking. The issue here is personality or ego is no substitute for actual deliverables. And a presidential meeting or stepping in to North Korea should be the deliverable or the win or the get at the end of an extended process run by national security professionals who define exactly what denuclearization means in the context of North Korea, and not just about the nuclear file in North Korea, but about the tyrannical, abysmal, human rights abusing regime that has led to an unbelievable tragedy in North Korea. And none of these issues have been advanced.
So the best case scenario out of this ad hoc meeting would be that there's actually something going on behind the scenes, some secret negotiation that we don't know about that brings North Korea back into the NPT in an agreement that covers the entire country and sets up this very robust access and verification regime. I don't think anybody thinks that's happening, but that would be the best case scenario. The worst case scenario, of course, is this idea of a nuclear freeze that Kim Jong-un takes this as like, hey, we're good. I don't actually have to take any further steps right now. And that's a problem not only because of North Korea, a country that has something like 20 to 30 weapons at its disposal, but anytime you're talking about nuclear politics, you're never talking about one country, right? North Korea isn't just about North Korea. North Korea is also about Iran, right? So you can't give one sweetheart deal to a country like North Korea that actually has nuclear weapons and is testing and then insist on an entirely different standard with a country like Iran, not to mention other countries in the Middle East that are also looking at whether or not they would like to have a nuclear weapons program. Nuclear policy is always about more than the one country that you're dealing with.
So Matthew, I'm hearing, and I tell you guys, stop me if I'm mischaracterizing. I'm hearing Dana say, hey, there's no substitute for professional diplomacy, well thought out, well planned, with a strategy written down that makes sense and is coherent. I'm hearing Jody say you've got to have international coherence. There has to be an approach internationally that makes sense in a bunch of different circumstances. You have to knit together the international community in a way that makes sense. And then I see President Trump basically talking to Kim Jong-un and saying, hey, you could develop these beaches. You could have a robust economy. We could start the engine going here and your people could prosper. There's some amazing things happening. Where do you land on this? It's kind of coming from the right as a Republican. Is it possible to have an economic diplomacy approach, a mercantilist approach that might actually draw North Korea into some sort of deal that made better sense than where we've been? We've tried professional approaches. We've tried international law approaches. What about the commercial approach? Why couldn't it work?
Well, I'm not saying it can't work. What I was talking about was just the symbolism of him crossing into the DMZ and then crossing back out. I don't see that as necessarily advancing what we're trying to do in North Korea. I think, you know, the economic approach could work, and clearly the administration thinks that approach may work, you know, when we talk about the Palestinians and Israel, because they rolled out the economic plan first and then they're going to do the political plan later. So I don't think it's wrong to show a little ankle and say, look, you could really have some terrific economic opportunities if you come to the table. But I think the problem that we face in North Korea is not dissimilar to the problem we face in Iran, which are two regimes that have quickly learned the lesson of what happened in Libya. You give up your nukes, you may wind up getting creamed down the road. And, you know, so what's my incentive to give up nukes? And I think that's the unfortunate thing that we're dealing with in both regimes.
So, Matthew, how do you square that possibility of a market economic approach to North Korea with massive sanctions on Iran, right? So in the one case with North Korea, 20 to 30 weapons, ongoing nuclear testing, and with Iran, which is obviously concerning, but we're talking about Iran getting just enough enriched uranium to create one possible weapon. How do you square that?
Well, I think while Iran aspires to have a nuclear arsenal, and we all believe based on the intelligence that North Korea has a robust one, North Korea is also not busy trying to wipe Israel off the face of the map. North Korea is not sponsoring proxies all over Southeast Asia to endanger our allies. I think Iran's behavior is very different than North Korea's. As awful as North Korea is, it's primarily awful to its own citizens.
Wait. Because you've got South Korea, you've got Japan, you've got
cyber.
Right. And U.S. access in the South China Sea, right? Like, it is not only about North Korea.
And very little of that has happened during this phase of the pen pal between Trump and Kim. I'm not saying it's sustainable, but let's, you know, in the last, 12 months, there haven't been rockets fired over Japan. And so I don't think it's wrong for the administration to try to show North Korea, here's your bright future if you actually sit down with us. I am skeptical that North Korea is going to take the bait.
I don't necessarily disagree with you. It's really just a question of the consistency of the policy, right? How do you have that type of policy toward North Korea while having this other very aggressive policy toward Iran?
I think the way they have behaved in their respective regions is different. I think it is different. I don't think they are the same. And I also don't think that we gave away the farm to North Korea in 2015 the way we did to Iran, and we basically gave it past Iran for all its bad acts. Now, we haven't been able to strike a deal with North Korea, but that's a problem that, as I said, the last four or five administrations have all struggled with.
All right, let's add China to the mix here. China's the big actor in the region. China's the primary patron of North Korea. Personally, I wonder why we don't just put all of the public onus on Beijing to try and solve this problem. They're very happy whenever the U.S. dives into the North Korea question and tries to solve it because it's so frustrating. And then it makes it look like China's not to blame. I view China as being largely responsible for the North Korea problem. But let's talk about their role. Right now, the U.S. and China are engaged in start and stop trade negotiations. A lot of money's at stake. There have been tariffs, billions of dollars in tariffs on each side. Business communities are involved. Real impact on American voters, potentially real impact on the Chinese economy. It seems like at the end of the day, that's going to be more of a driver politically in the two most important countries in the world than even North Korea is going to be. So given the fact that President Trump was willing to, at least in part, trade away the Huawei issue, you know, this Chinese telecom that has real national security implications for the United States, that he was willing to trade away part of his attack on Huawei to advance the trade deal, to advance trade negotiations between Washington and Beijing. Is it possible that North Korea becomes a football in the battle between Washington and Beijing over a trade deal? Is there a way to and do we want this? Is there a way to make it part of the calculus between the world's two most important countries, some sort of resolution to the Korean Peninsula problem as part of a Washington-Beijing negotiation?
So,
Jody.
I think that North Korea has always been that football for China, right, for years and years and years, not new to this administration. China has all of the leverage in this relationship. It is North Korea's overwhelmingly primary trading partner. And China has a long history of tightening and loosening its market relationship with North Korea in pretty much direct correspondence to how it's feeling about the United States at any given moment in time. You can't really blame them for this. It's great leverage for them. Do I think it feeds into negotiations on trade and tariffs? I would presume that it does. Having said that, both sides do actually need a trade agreement, right? Nobody wants to go into the next election, Trump or Democrats, frankly, with this standoff on tariff, and it's not good for China either. So, you know, there's got to be an agreement on tariffs. And secondly, I'd just say on Huawei, I was disappointed to see that concession. I don't think it was.
I think we had all agreed that would not.
It was not,
and then it happened.
It was not appropriately reciprocal.
Matthew.
I agree. I think we gave away a little too much on Huawei. I am somewhat skeptical that even if we get a deal with China, a decent deal with China, I'm skeptical that North Korea will get wrapped into it in any really substantive way because it is such a wonderful leverage point for China. I can't imagine them ever negotiating that away. And the last thing the Chinese want is a unified democratic Korea on their border. And I just don't see them giving up on their puppet anytime soon.
All right, let's close out this round with a quick question, yes or no question for everyone. In the next 18 months, will there be any kind of deal between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, even an interim deal that would lead to something else later? Is there going to be anything written down of substance between Pyongyang and Washington.
Well, you just said of substance. So I'm going to go ahead and say no.
I'm going to say confidence building measures.
So, which is not necessarily substantive.
Which is not necessarily substantive, but there's lots of history on that issue.
Matthew.
There'll be something in writing. People will sign it. And then a podcast 3 years from now will debate how substantive it was.
I'll agree with Jody and say there will be confidence building measures that will be modestly substantive, and something will happen between the two countries. All right, let's get to our final topic before we go to our final thing, which is the things that we're all individually following. So, third topic is the G20, the biggest economies in the world gathered in Osaka, Japan, a couple of weeks ago for negotiations among multilaterally and bilaterally between various parties. They were able to come up with a consensus document at the end that was pretty light, basically some words that they all agreed to, no real commitments to a way forward. It was all kind of subsumed by the dance along the DMZ in Korea a day or two later. But let's go back to the G20. What do we think about these confabs, these giant productions that, you know, like the State Department prepares for a year or more going into one of these meetings? Is it a valuable use of resources diplomatically and otherwise? Do we get anything out of this? Is it just some headlines that don't really matter, or is there some real substance that happens here? Dana.
I mean, I think that they could be good opportunities to deliver on substance if the members of the G20 with their strong economies were willing to put money behind the pledges and statements in terms of addressing economic inequality, in terms of addressing the most severe refugee crisis population movements across the world that we've seen, certainly of this century, of the intractable conflicts, and actually state things of significance that would matter to the governments not attending, that there would be some alignment. Unfortunately, that's not what this one was. And I think it would be very difficult for a lot of the attending governments to make those commitments and follow through with substance, given how divided so many of them are at home.
Jody.
So I think if we're going to talk about the G20, we have to talk about some of the actors that were at the G20. Strong economic leaders and strong leaders in an authoritarian sense.
Strong men.
Strong men, strong authoritarian leaders were all on stage. And it was a bit disconcerting to see some of them, like MBS. So this is one of the first large meetings that Mohammed bin Salman, the leader of purported leader of future leader, if you will, of Saudi Arabia, was at after Khashoggi's death, right? And everybody's pretty aware that he had almost certainly had a role in that. And so it was disconcerting to see him warmly welcomed in that atmosphere, or really for nobody to take him on directly, particularly knowing that the next G20 meeting in November 2020 will be in Saudi Arabia. And I think the thing to keep in mind in that regard, because somebody will inevitably say, well, you got to be realistic, this is what the world is like, is to keep in mind that authoritarian leaders and authoritarian states are inherently unstable places. They give off an aroma of strength, but people don't like to be oppressed and they don't like to live in fear.
So, Matthew, what's the value of seeing these folks in public and on display? You know, we saw President Trump sit down with Vladimir Putin and kind of jokingly say to him, hey, don't interfere with our elections. There, I said it. It was to some a rebuke of all the criticism Trump's gotten, to others a very embarrassing conduct by our chief executive. Is there a value in kind of seeing how these leaders conduct themselves when they're near each other and when they're around? Are we getting some value out of this exercise?
I think we get some value. So I think I've always viewed these events as, you know, that there are a lot of people that worry about the substance of the event and the agenda and what order. I think all that is de minimis value. I do think there is a marginal value, depending on context and timing, of having these leaders come together, because it does create a forcing action by the national security apparatus of this country and every other country to think about, okay, when the chief executive meets with Putin or whomever, what do we want him to say? What do we want him to be thinking about? So I think there is some marginal value in sort of as a forcing action. But I think looking to these events to solve a lot of the major world crises that we just talked about a moment ago, I think that's kind of blowing into the wind.
I think it would be nice if these confabs were actually forcing functions for an organized and deliberate national security process in which maybe the action isn't the photo opportunities, but all the bilateral meetings behind closed doors where business actually gets done. The problem is, in these sorts of contexts, you have, in at least when it comes to the current administration, a president who doesn't like to be staffed, who doesn't like to read memos, and seems to be rather undisciplined in whether or not he actually delivers on whatever the national security apparatus prepares for him. So in that sense, it was probably a missed opportunity.
I think for me, as much as I didn't love everything that came out of the G20 meeting, I do tend to think that face-to-face meetings at the end of the day provide a useful way to engage leader to leader. There really is no substitute for meeting somebody face-to-face.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about Dana's idea, though, that you've got to have some action behind the scenes. There needs to be real professional diplomacy. President brought members of his family with him to Osaka. They play key roles in his administration as advisors to him. They're not people who would otherwise have those jobs in any other administration. The only qualification is a blood or marriage relationship to the president. What do we think about that? Maybe even from a congressional oversight perspective, the Constitution's pretty clear about the role of Congress in overseeing the executive branch in terms of personnel and policies and agreements. The founding fathers and the Federalist Papers wrote a lot about the role of the Senate in particular in being the advisors to the chief executive and having more of a long-term view. What do we kind of think of this new amateurism in foreign policy? Does anyone want to take a shot at that?
Well, I think it is specific to the Trump administration. So we haven't seen anything quite like this before. I doubt we'll see anything quite like this after. I think it is just – it is our president has the utmost faith in his family members. That seems to be how he operates. I think from a Senate oversight perspective, I'd be more concerned if, as I said a moment ago, I thought the G20 was more meaningful as an event. But I just don't see it as being such a huge event. So I put in the category of weird but not dangerous to the Republic.
Yeah.
So I think it depends. So first of all, from a congressional oversight perspective, it has always been difficult for Congress to conduct oversight of staff inside the White House and the National Security Council because they are not Senate-confirmed positions. So that in and of itself. So for example, the Senate cannot drag the National Security Advisor to testify to Congress about a particular issue. Number two, I mean, the optics were not, I would say, favorable for the United States to not see the National Security Advisor or not see the Secretary of State and instead see the president's daughter while his son-in-law, so the relation by marriage, was apparently offering another real estate deal to the Palestinians in Bahrain. And finally, while specifically at the G20, other than a lot of snarking about who was in the pictures did not come out, we know before the G20 that there have been issues where foreign governments have sought to influence or gain favor with the president or foreign policy agreements that are favorable to these governments by potentially granting concessions or making policy statements that are favorable to his children or his relations by marriage. And so a good example is trademarks being granted by China to Ivanka Trump.
A lot of great issues to discuss. Jerry, let me ask you about the National Security Advisor, John Bolton. Instead of being at the DMZ with the president, he was in Mongolia. He was a little bit mocked for going to a country a lot of people thought was irrelevant and that he was kind of sent off to get out of the way because he's so tough on Pyongyang. President Trump's looking to cut a deal. He thought John Bolton might get in the way, so let's send him off to Mongolia was the story. What do you think of that? What's the real background on our initiative?
So I'll say two things. It was a surprise that John Bolton was not with Donald Trump during those meetings and at the DMZ, right? At the same time, I wouldn't mock him for going to Mongolia. Mongolia has been, for a pretty long period of time, a stable, important democratic ally in a part of the world that is not stable and democratic. So multiple successive administrations have made a point of maintaining and growing U.S. relations with Mongolia. For most Americans, that might not be a country they think a lot about. But in U.S. foreign policy, Mongolia is actually not such a small actor.
All right, great. Let's close out this segment and let's talk about maybe some quick issues behind the headlines that some of us are following. I'll jump out first. I thought the administration's new initiative, Prosper Africa, which has a ton of potential, real business-to-business relationships between the United States and Africa, which could be a real challenge to what China's trying to do there with its Belt and Road Initiative. It was a terrific opportunity for the administration that was a little bit fumbled. The administration couldn't figure out how to send a cabinet member to Maputo for this announcement. They ended up sending the deputy commerce secretary and the USAID administrator, both good people, but not necessarily of high enough level to show the importance of this initiative. I think it's a little bit of a missed opportunity, at least in the announcement. But I think overall, we should be paying attention to what the administration could be doing in Africa, maybe help them do the right thing and see some opportunities there. So that's what I'm watching. Dana.
So I'm watching the UK have its WikiLeaks moment with the poor British ambassador who had sent a series of cables back to London about assessing how decision-making and policy-making gets done in the current administration that were not very flattering of the president and his team, and also providing advice to officials in the British government about how to talk and how to behave with the president in order to maintain the US-UK special relationship. And actually, if you look at what the UK is doing, they are working very hard to align with the United States on issues. If you look at tensions related to the Iran, the UK has tried to side with the US as much as it could. They're continuing to do military cooperation in areas in the Middle East that are arguably a danger to everybody. But instead, the focus and presidential tweeting has focused on the British ambassador and these private cables. And in the end today, it's now not under the headlines less, but actually on the headlines because he has resigned.
Jody.
So I thought this might be an Onion article, but Washington is going to have a new think tank funded by George Soros, the liberal, and Charles Koch, the conservative, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, that is going to focus on finding diplomatic rather than military solutions to global problems. It's an interesting idea. I think its success will probably depend on whether or not they table credible solutions like addressing AUMF policy or if they go straight after things like defense spending, which would be a non-starter in this town, both because of the situation we find ourselves in vis-a-vis China and Russia, but also because of the impacts on the U.S. economy and U.S. jobs.
Matthew, bring us home.
If I asked you, what are these companies have in common? Amazon, Sony, Microsoft, Google, Nintendo, HP, Dell, GoPro, Hasbro, Steve Madden, the shoemaker, Stanley Black & Decker, Brooks Running, and Whirlpool Corp. What would be the answer? If you said they're all pulling portions of their production facilities in China out of China, you would be the winner. And I think this is an interesting subtext to the current tensions between the U.S. and China when it comes to trade. Because to the extent that these companies and many multinationals are doing this, reorient their supply chains and move them to places like Thailand and Vietnam and Mexico, I think the incentives for both sides to strike deals or to maintain a certain level of cordiality between them lessens. So I think it's one of those indicators that we should all be watching in terms of future relations between the U.S. and China on the economic front.
All right. Thanks, all. That's it for this episode of Fault Lines. Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll see you next time.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.